Okay, everyone, so let's continue. So this is the Rohitasa Sutta, and it's quite a nice and in some ways quite a profound sutta, and it kind of gives a nice summary, I think, to the Four Noble Truths. And this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then, when the night had advanced, the young Deva, Rohitasa, of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jeta's Grove, approached the Blessed One. He paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said, "Is it possible, Bhante, by traveling to know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not grow old and die, does not pass away and get reborn? I say, friend, that by traveling one cannot know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not grow old, does not die, does not pass away and get reborn. It is astounding and amazing, Bhante, how well this was stated by the Blessed One. I say that you cannot do it in this way. In the past, Bhante, I was a seer, like a sage, sage seer named Rohitasa, son of Bhoja, one possessing psychic potency, able to travel through the sky. My speed was like that of a light arrow, easily shot by a firmed bowed archer, one trained, skilled, and experienced, across the shadow of a palm tree. My stride was such that it could reach from the eastern ocean to the western ocean. Then, while I possessed such speed and such a stride, the wish arose in me, I will reach the end of the world by traveling. Having a lifespan of 100 years, living for 100 years, I traveled for 100 years without pausing, except to eat, drink, chew, and taste, to defecate and urinate, and to dispel fatigue with sleep. Yet I died along the way without having reached the end of the world. It is astounding and amazing, Bhante, how well this was stated by the Blessed One. I say, friend, that by traveling one cannot know, see, or reach the end of the world, where one is not born, does not grow old or die, does not pass away and get reborn. So here you have this seer, Rohitasa, this ancient sage from a long time ago, and in the meantime he has been reborn in the Devaloka, and you can see here the Devas that come down and ask the Buddha's question. Yeah, it's quite cool, the Devas come down. So if you get reborn in Devaloka and Maitreya happens to get reborn in the meantime, you just come down, yeah, and you say, "I've got a few questions." So it's no problem. You can still visit Maitreya even if you're a Deva. Sometimes easier if you are a Deva than if you are human. All the humans, they have to queue up. You just kind of come from above, bang, straight down there. Kind of sneaking a little bit in the queue. Huh? So here was a sage, he was a spiritual practitioner, so obviously he was seeking to find an end to the same problems the Buddha was seeking to find an end to, yeah? The problems of birth and old age and getting reborn and all of these kind of things. But instead of trying to find it inwardly by going into meditation, he tried to find it outside, traveling around, see how far it go to the end of the universe. I don't know. I'm not sure if the end of the universe. Was that Douglas Adams? He had a famous English author who died quite a while ago. He had this The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and there's a restaurant at the end of the universe. I'm not sure if Rohitasa probably didn't find that restaurant at the end of the universe. Otherwise, one more step and bang, you're outside. But there is no such thing. Yeah, there is no restaurant at the end of the universe. This is completely silly. Because the universe, from modern physics point of view, there is no end to it anyway. If you keep on going far enough in one direction, you supposedly come back where you started out again, eventually. Yeah. So the universe is like a closed system, and there is no limit to it. There is no end to it. There is no kind of external thing here. So you cannot step out of the universe, even if you have psychic powers. And this is what Rohitasa found. This is the wrong way of finding the end to these problems. And then the Buddha says, and the following, I say, friend, that by traveling one cannot know, see, or reach that end of the world where one is not born, does not grow old and die, does not pass away and get reborn. Yet I say that without having reached the end of the world, there is no making an end of suffering. It is in this fathom-long body, endowed with perception and mind, that I claim the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. This fathom-long body, endowed with perception and mind, that's the five khandhas, yeah? That's us, that's who we are as beings. Fathom-long body with perception and mind. It's just a way of saying mind and body, really. And it is here. The world is not something that we find outside. It is within ourselves. That is where you find the world. Yeah, it is in here that the world is. What does that mean? What does it mean that the world is found inside of us? And what it means is that there is really only one world that we can ever know, and that is our own world, our own experience. Yeah, your experience right now, that is your world. And if you add up all the experiences that you have had in your life, that's the kind of the sum of the entire world that you have created, that you have experienced. Yeah, that is the world. And why is that the world? Well, the reason why, because that is the only world that matters to us, is our experience of the world. Yeah, I sit here, I see all these things, yeah, I perceive things, I kind of have maybe some volition for things, I feel kind of, you know, feel quite happy to be here, and all of that is my world right now. Everything that is kind of coming into my mind is created in the mind. Yeah, all of these colors or whatever, you can say from a modern point of view, they don't really exist apart from the creation in your mind. They're just different wavelengths of light, but the colors are a creation of the mind. So everything is really just internal in our own mind. What is outside? Who knows what's outside? But the world is really our experience. That is the world that matters. Why is that the world that matters? Well, because this is where you have suffering and happiness, is in your experience. Suffering and happiness doesn't exist in the world outside. So all the problems we have, all the happinesses we have, all the whatever it is inside of us. It is within our mind, within our body. That is the world that actually has any meaning. The external world is actually quite meaningless to us in terms of, when I mean external world, I just mean like, I don't mean other people or that. What I mean is just the world that we cannot experience at all, yeah? Whatever is outside of our experience. I'm not sure if I'm being very clear about this, but in the end, everything comes back to our experience. That is the only world we can ever really know, and that is the world that we have to deal with. And that is where you find suffering, yeah? It is that experienced world where you find the end of suffering, where you find the path. The path is really just a mental thing. It is something that happens inside our minds. That's the path. Yeah, the path is about purifying ourselves, getting the insights, getting the samadhi. It all happens internally. It is found nowhere else. So this is what the Buddha means here by the Four Noble Truths actually being a part of our, just simply being our world. So the word world is here equivalent to experience. And experience is equivalent to the five khandhas. Five khandhas equivalent to dukkha. All of these things basically mean the same thing from a Buddhist point of view. These are not separate things. Yeah, and so it's obvious, if the world is our internal world, then of course it doesn't make any sense to travel anywhere. Yeah, traveling kind of doesn't make any sense anymore. You have to go inside to sort these things out. That is where you find the solution to these things. It is the world of experience that matters. So you look inside, and that's where you find the solution to what is going on. The world, the origin of the world, yeah, the origin of the world is craving, as we have seen. It's illusion. And that craving is also an inner state inside of us. So experience, the world happens because we crave and we recreate experience again and again. The world arises from that craving, always projecting ourselves into the future. And when the end of the world, really, then what does that mean then? Well, it means that when craving stops, experience stops. Yeah, that's what it means. The five khandhas are really all about experience. So when experience stops, that is the meaning of the end of the world. This fathom-long body with its mind and perception, that is the world, that is the end. When that stops, that is actually the end of the world. That is what the Buddha is saying here. So the world stops, our world stops, our personal world, our individual world, our subjective world, that is what stops. Any other world, it's very hard to say whether it exists or not. And then you have the path that leads to that ending of the world. And that is the path which, again, is just this mental development that we are practicing inside of us. So the question sometimes is, well, what does this mean in practice? Does this mean that the world is just an illusion and all there is experience? You may have heard that, you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, they talk about the mind-only school and these kind of things. And these are what is called idealism in philosophy. Idealism is that everything is just the mind. Yeah, the external world, there is no external world. Everything is just mind, just experience. This, my experience right now, that's all there is. Yeah, is that what the Buddha is saying? What exactly is the Buddha saying here? It sounds a bit like idealism, the way he's talking about this. But I think that would be going too far to say the Buddha is talking about idealism. What the Buddha is saying is that the world that matters, the world that is important to us, is the inner world, is our experience. As far as external phenomena, the world outside, well, we just don't know anything about that. And because we don't know anything about it, it's kind of irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference anyway, as far as our suffering and happiness is concerned. So I don't think the Buddha takes a position on that, whether the world is really according to idealism or not. And it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. We don't want to get too much into philosophy anyway. But just as a kind of interest, point of interest, because we're talking about this particular sutta. I don't want to go into the sutta much more because it is a little bit philosophical, and it is probably, if you are a philosopher, you can probably talk about this sutta for a long time, but I'm not a philosopher, so there's a limit to what I can say about this. But it's kind of nice. It gives a different perspective on the teachings of the Buddha. And then he says, at the end there, the end of the world can never be reached by means of traveling across the world. Yet without reaching the world's end, there is no release from suffering. So you have to reach the end of the world within. Hence the wise one, the world knower, who has reached the world's end and lived the spiritual life, having known the world's end at peace, does not desire this world or another. That is the Buddha's summary of that. Does that make any sense to anyone? Yeah? Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. So it's quite profound, these kind of things. But it's kind of, it still, I think, can be quite useful to look at things in that particular way. Okay, any questions about that? No? Everybody okay? So now... We have finished looking at what I would call delusion, avidya. We've had a kind of a broad look at that, and the reason why I have looked so much at this and taken up, we're already on the fourth day of this retreat. Yeah, today is Tuesday, is that right? Something like that, yeah? I'm not sure what day it is. Is it Tuesday today? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Tuesday. Yeah, today's Tuesday. Okay, today's Tuesday already, yeah. The nice thing about being a monk, you don't have to know what day it is. Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. Yeah, the month, the day, the year even doesn't really matter here. Yeah. I heard a story that Ram said that he was traveling once in Thailand after his fifth rains. And he was traveling around and he forgot what year it was. Yeah, he didn't know what year it was anymore. Yeah. It's kind of nice. Yeah, timelessness, absolute timelessness. No idea what's happening here. And I think that's really quite cool. So, but the reason why I spend so much time on this is precisely because it is so important, this idea of not non-delusion, of seeing things in the right way here. And once that is in place, then we can start looking at the rest of dependent origination. And what I want to look at next is, because avijja is such an important thing here, we need to know a little bit about what causes it. What are the things that give rise to this avijja? And once we understand this whole causal process in more detail, then we can also start to undermine it. Yeah? What are the things we need to do to undermine this avijja so we can have more straight view, more undistorted vision of reality, more seeing things according to what they really are. So this is the exciting thing that's coming up now, yeah? Are you excited about this? Now we're going to see how not to be deluded, how to have more straight view of things. I think this is very exciting myself, because it kind of gives us the key, yeah, the key to how to resolve this whole problem, and so we can get out of suffering, get out of problems, and find happiness. Yay! So, this is the next sutta we're going to look at, and I did look at this sutta last year, but I think it's such a nice little sutta that I'd like to do it again this year as well. This sutta is called Avijja, Delusion. And it goes as follows, on page 21 in your little booklet. Because this is said, a first point of delusion, because is not seen, such that before this there was no delusion, and afterwards it came into being. Still, delusion is seen to have a specific condition. So what does this mean? What this means is that delusion is self-perpetuating. This is what this means. You go back in time, and there is no first point at which delusion started. This always goes back again and again and again. And this is very further and further and further, I should say. And this is very similar to what we were talking about the other day, about the idea of the universe, yeah? The universe also has no first point. There's no first point when the universe started. It also goes back and back and back. And if you think about the sutta we were just looking at now, the Rohitasa Sutta, that the world and our experience are equivalent, then of course it makes sense that delusion and the world and the universe also, in a sense, are equivalent. Yeah, if the universe has no point, then delusion also must have no first point, because these two must go together backwards in time. Our experience goes backward. Our experience exists because of delusion, and experience is equivalent to the universe, so the two must go back together, back into the unfathomable past. Yeah, like I was saying the other day, it's a beautiful way of looking at the world, this idea that there is no first point. There's just causality, going another cause before another cause, going back and back and back. No first beginning, yeah, can be found, says the Buddha. So this means that ignorance is self-perpetuating. Once you're ignorant, you will remain ignorant. Yeah, once you're deluded, you will remain deluded, because delusion creates more delusion. This is kind of the problem. And this is precisely why you need a circuit breaker to kind of snap that circuit where delusion creates more delusion. And that circuit breaker, what is that? The Buddha. The Buddha is the circuit breaker. Is that kind of being a bit bad, saying the Buddha is a circuit breaker? I'm not sure. But it's just a way of thinking about the Buddha. He breaks that kind of wrong view, creating wrong view. Yeah, like the vipalasas, the delusions of the mind, whereby you have wrong view, and that wrong view affects your perceptions. You have distorted perception lead to distorted thoughts lead to distorted views, distorted views lead to distorted perception, lead to distorted thoughts, and on it goes, round and round and round, and there's no way of breaking out of that, unless you have someone who gives you guidance and says, listen, actually, there's another way of looking at this. The Buddha, the eye of the world, says, this is what you do, yeah? This is where you stop this, and this is how you get out of this problem. So unless you have some kind of circuit breaker somewhere that kind of tells you the problem, you will just keep on going. Delusion will perpetuate itself again and again and again into the future. And that is why there is no first point in this, and that's why there is a danger that you will keep on doing this forever in the future as well. There is no limit to this, basically. So that's why, you know, you have to take the opportunity when it arises to kind of break out of this self-perpetuating cycle of dukkha. That's really what it is. Self-perpetuating cycle of dukkha. I like that. That's the kind of that's a nice way of thinking about samsara. So, and then he says that a first point cannot be seen. Yeah, the Buddha is not saying that this goes back infinitely in the past. And this is one of the other interesting things about the Buddha. You cannot say anything about infinity. What you can say is that I have looked as far back as I possibly can, many eons into the past, and by looking back as far as I can, I didn't find any first point. And this is kind of one of the things about the Buddha, which is interesting about him, is that he stops with the evidence. Yeah, this is the evidence we have. It's like science. We have this evidence. The evidence points to this, but it doesn't go beyond the evidence and say, well, actually, there is no absolute beginning at all. But as far as we can go back, we cannot see any first point. The idea is that you have empirical investigations. So you look at the empirical evidence. Okay, this is what I've seen. And then you speak based on that. In later Buddhism, they claim more than that. In later Buddhism, they claim that actually there is no first point at all. But at that point, you're moving from empirical evidence to speculation. Yeah, because you cannot say anything about absolute beginnings. There is being no, you cannot go back into infinity. That's impossible. Because infinity, by definition, is not something you can go into. You cannot, infinity is, there's always more before it. So you can never reach into infinity. All you can say, this is what I've seen. No first point of ignorance can be seen. This is a beautiful thing about the Buddha's teaching, and one of the things that gives you confidence about them, that they limit themselves to that which is observable. He talks about personal experience, doesn't go beyond that. So this is what we are seeing here. So, no first point of ignorance. And yet, despite that, ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. So what does it mean? How can it have a condition if there is no first point? And the reason it can have a condition is because ignorance is not a fixed thing, yeah? Or delusion is not fixed. One day you are more deluded, another day you are less deluded. Some day you're almost not deluded at all because there are no hindrances in the mind. Other days you are really deluded because you are kind of, the hindrances are all over the place. So, in other words, delusion varies, and the variation in delusion depends on other conditions. That is why it is said to have a specific condition. It doesn't have an absolute cause, but it has specific condition. So what that means is that once delusion has a specific condition, it means that we want to put into place those conditions that minimize our delusion. Yeah, the less delusion there is, the more straight view we have. That is where the possibility of escaping, the possibility of seeing things according to reality, that is where it is. Yeah, you can see how this kind of hangs together. So we're going to minimize delusion. So how do we do that? Well, we're going to have to look at this causal sequence that comes afterwards here. I say, monks, that ignorance has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for ignorance? It should be said the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana. The five hindrances too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the five hindrances? It should be said the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. What is the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct? It should be said non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. What is the nutriment for the non-restraint of the sense faculties? It should be said lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension? It should be said careless attention. Careless attention too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for careless attention? It should be said lack of faith or lack of confidence. Lack of confidence too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without a nutriment. What is the nutriment for lack of faith? It should be said, not hearing the good Dhamma, the Sadhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for not hearing the good Dhamma? It should be said, not associating with good persons, or with superior persons, or with the Aryas. That's what that refers to. Asapurisa sangseva, associating with the wrong kind of people. So there you are. That is the reason why you are deluded. Yeah, this whole sequence shows you how delusion arises. It's interesting, isn't it? At the very root there, you find the reason why you're deluded is because you're associating with the wrong people. That's the kind of root cause. Yeah, that's why we all deluded because of that. And the more, it means that the more you associate with the right people, the more you hear the good Dhamma, the less deluded you are going to be through this whole process that is happening here. So, the root cause is always associating with the wrong people. So let's have a look at this whole sequence and see how it actually works out. Five hindrances are the nutriment. So what does nutriment mean? Nutriment means condition. It means cause. Yeah? If something has a nutriment, like if you eat, if you give a child food, the child grows up. If you give nutriment to a plant, the plant becomes nice and strong. Yeah? You give it water, you give it kind of some extra things for the plant, so it becomes happy. Yeah? Nutriment is something that causes something else to grow. Yeah, so this is the point here. When we say the five hindrances are the nutriment for delusion, it causes delusion to grow if you have more five hindrances. So we want to reduce the five hindrances to the minimum. So we deprive delusion of its nutriment. So nutriment, delusion cannot grow anymore. If you deprive the nutriment completely from a plant, if you stop watering a plant, eventually the plant dies. And in the same way, if you keep on taking away the nutriment of the five hindrances from delusion, eventually delusion also will have to die as a consequence. So part of this is the idea here of right view also comes in here. It is assumed here because it is assumed at the bottom that you have wrong view because you're associating with the wrong people. That also is part of what's going on here. Remove the five hindrances and then you have the right view. Bang, delusion ends up being completely undermined as a consequence. So these are the two factors of nutriment, yeah? They allow something to exist and they also feed it to make it worse. So why is it that the five hindrances are the nutriment to delusion? This is actually very useful again to reflect on this and to see this in your own life, how this actually works. When you have clarity of mind. Yeah, you sit down, your mind is quite clear. As someone was saying the other day, it varies a lot. The mind is so variable. Sometimes you go into ordinary life and the mind is all over the place, really confused. You don't know up from down. You forget about the Dhamma. This is really hard. And other times you feel quite peaceful and nice and you have a sense of clarity. Yeah, and one of the main differences there is that the clarity is much stronger when there are no hindrances in the mind. Notice that. And notice that when you feel angry, you don't really often know what is right and wrong anymore. When you act on anger, very often you regret it afterwards. Why? Because you didn't know what you were doing at the time. Yeah? You lacked clarity. You were deluded, basically. Yeah? Very strong desires also. Desires make us act in the wrong way. We do silly things when desires become very strong. And this again is exactly the same thing. Afterwards, we regret that. Yeah, we had a kind of extramarital relationship or something like that. I would think, no, that was a mistake. Why did I do that for? That was crazy. And we're kind of drawn out in the wrong way because of the defilements of the mind. And this is, so it's quite easy to see this. Notice your own mind. When you have clarity inside, that is when you feel that you can trust your intuition, you can trust your understanding of the world, when you are relaxed and you are clear, and you're kind of just looking at the world from that sense of clear perspective of what is going on. And this is one of the basic advice I often give to people, is that if you're going to make a decision in your life, How should we make decisions? People ask these kind of questions all the time. How do we make decisions? One of the basic ways of making decisions is only make a decision when you have a sense of clarity here. Don't make important decisions, or even small ones, when you are confused, when you are angry, when you have desire, when you feel really agitated, because you're going to make stupid decisions at that time. Wait till you have a chance to calm down, sit back, yeah, go to a nice and quiet place, come here to the BGF, sit down, do some meditation, do it at home if you have a little place where you do your meditation at home. Find the peace and calm and relaxation. And when your mind is clear, then often the intuition will tell you, yes, this is the right thing to do. The answer will just come to you. It will be very obvious what is the right thing. But don't make the decision when you are confused, because the intuition is unreliable if you have defilements in the mind. Intuition is perfectly valid way of making decisions. But remember, intuition is only reliable if the mind is not defiled, if the mind is clear. Then the intuition will be reliable. So we are distorted by the five hindrances. And sometimes it is very hard to see these distortions. They can be very small. But even if there's a tiny bit of these five hindrances, yeah, that is enough to distort your outlook. Why? Because we have a vested interest. If you have sensual desire, even just a little bit of sensual desire, it means you have a vested interest in the world of the five senses. You want to hold on. I want to see at the very least. Yeah, I want to be able to hear. Cutting off the hearing is not nice if you enjoy a bit of music or you enjoy whatever it is. But in meditation, there comes a point when you have to let go completely of your ability to hear. The only way you can do that is if you have no sensual desire whatsoever. You don't really care about hearing anything anymore. And you're able to allow that, to let that go completely. This is how profound it is. Yeah, it's actually quite profound. We think that sensual desire just means not having kind of coarse desires about things. No, it means the very ability to let go of the entire sensory world. And that's why people feel it's scary, because it's so close to us. We identify with this, yeah? Actually, it's not scary at all. It's actually blooming marvelous, yeah? To get rid of all of that, because it feels nice. You feel so happy afterwards. It's really good. But the transition is always a bit scary here. Once you get there, it's actually very, very useful. But that is the depth of what we're talking about here. And only then, when you let go of all that, five hindrances are completely gone, then there is no support for delusion anymore. Delusion has lost its support. It's kind of still hanging there, yeah? You still have a bit of delusion because you haven't completely got rid of it, but the support is no longer there. And that is why, at that particular point, is the right time to overthrow, if you like, delusion and see things according to reality. Give up the five hindrances. That is where the possibility is. And this is why so much of the Buddhist path is about overcoming the five hindrances. This is why samadhi is so important, because samadhi means the overcoming of the five hindrances, and it means creating a mind which is stable, a mind where the hindrances don't come back very easily. Hindrances are gone for long periods of time. That's what samadhi does to you. This is how this works, yeah? And then, when that samadhi is there, then you can kind of change your outlook completely, because your mind is able to do that. So five hindrances, yeah? This is what we should overcome on the Buddhist path. So how do we overcome that? And it says here that the nutriment for the five hindrances is three kinds of wrong conduct. Three kinds of wrong conduct is body, speech, and mind. So, if you keep the five precepts, you're already undermining the five hindrances. Yeah. It's quite good, isn't it? You only have to keep in the five precepts, or already undermining the hindrances. So whenever we act in the right way, whenever we kind of live well, whenever we act in the right way, speak in the right way, actually these things are coming down a little bit already. Because to consistently be able to live well, to do that consistently, the only way you're going to do that is by learning how to look at other people in a different way. Yeah, so if you're going to be kind all the time, if you are really going to do that, you have to learn also to look at these people differently. Otherwise, you won't be able to act with kindness all the time. So simply by simply by speaking in the right way, acting in the right way, already undermining the five hindrances. And of course, the last one is the misconduct of mind. Yeah, if you have mental misconduct, that's very similar to the five hindrances already. But by clearing up the mind and sorting that out, of course, reducing the hindrances even more. So as long as we don't keep the precept, as long as we act with this sort of misconduct, we are keeping up five hindrances, keeping up delusion, and everything is becoming problematic as a consequence. So what is the nutriment of the three kinds of misconduct? Non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties means that your senses are going all over the place, enjoying this, enjoying that, getting upset here, getting desire there. That is what it means. So how can we restrain the sense faculties? And the answer is, ideally, by using wisdom power. Try to be wise. Try to understand the problems that arise in the mind when you don't restrain the sense faculties, at least a little bit. So how do we do this in practice? Actually, it sounds a bit obscure when you read it here, but in practice it just means that you have enough awareness in your daily life to see, especially when anger is arising. Anger is the biggest problem. Don't worry too much about the sensual pleasures. So you have enough awareness, enough mindfulness to see that now I'm about to become angry. Because the mindfulness is there, you're able to take a different route. Yeah? Why are you getting angry with someone? Yeah, maybe one of your fellows here irritates you a little bit. It's impossible that shouldn't happen. Yeah, admit it. Of course, the people around you irritate us a little bit. It's just the way it has to be. Can't be any different. When you live so closely together, it's always like that. So what do you do then if one of your fellow BGF members gets on your nerves a little bit? Well, what you do is that you just remember what a wonderful thing it is to have people like this as my friends. Yeah. It's great. These are all really good people. These are people who are trying their very best. They're not going to be perfect, of course, but their heart is in the right place. What a wonderful thing it is to have friends like this. Yeah, and this is the great thing about being part of a community of people who actually try to live well. It is actually very easy to see the good qualities of people like that. So remember the big picture. And when you remember the big picture, you turn your mind to those good qualities, and then whatever thing irritates you, it's just gone. This is how you avoid getting upset and angry with people. This is one way. There are many other ways as well. It's not that hard to do. Yeah, everybody can do this. Don't use too much willpower to try to suppress the anger, because usually the Buddha doesn't really recommend that anywhere. And also, it's not really sustainable in the long run. Much better to use a bit of wisdom in the way I was suggesting now. If you can do this, you can really transform the way you look at people and the world around you. This is what sense restraint basically means. In terms of desires, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. Of course, as long as you keep your five precepts, or you keep your eight precepts when you go on a retreat, if you can do that, it's great. Yeah, that is the main restraint in the realm of sense desire. Beyond that, you can go beyond that, but go beyond that maybe when you go on retreat. In daily life, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Sometimes people try to be too perfect, and it leads to too many problems for them, and too much suffering. So try to find the middle way here. So that is sense restraint. What is it that gives rise to sense restraint? The nutriment for the lack of sense restraint is the lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Yeah? Is that right? Yeah? Okay. suddenly you forget one factor. So, why is that? Why, if we have no mindfulness, why is it that we cannot have any sense restraint? And of course the reason is that sense restraint relies on our ability to be aware of what's happening in the present moment. You have to be able to see that the mind is heading in the wrong direction, that you are about to get angry, that you are about to have some kind of wrong kind of desire or whatever. Yeah, it relies on that awareness to enable you to have sense restraint. If you have no awareness at all of what's going on, and sometimes this may happen in daily life. Yeah, things are happening so fast, you're talking too quickly, and before you know it, you have said the wrong thing. Oops, no mindfulness. Yeah, this happens so easily here. So mindfulness is really the requirement for sense restraint to be possible. So no mindfulness or a low degree of mindfulness, there's always a little bit of mindfulness there, but a low degree of mindfulness is going to not enable you to stop yourself when you're going down the wrong track. This is all this means. Yeah, there's nothing really kind of difficult about this, or nothing very secret or kind of weird about this. These are the very natural things that apply to us in ordinary life. Clear comprehension is called here, or full awareness. Sampajanya goes together with sati. And sampajanya is just to know the things in the life that will support your practice. So you try to avoid those things that will be unsupportive, and you try to do those things that are supportive. Yeah. So you don't gamble so much. Yeah. So you reduce your gambling habits. No, I'm sure not many. I don't know if any of you here gamble. I'm sure you're very. You don't do that kind of stuff. But sometimes, you know, I remember when I was a lay person, I sometimes when I had the opportunity, very occasionally, I would do some gambling. And I think because I had seen the James Bond movies, I thought, yeah, you've got to do some gambling to be really cool, right? Just like James Bond, you go to the blackjack table and you kind of, whatever it is. But it was only happened a couple of times. These are the kind of things that create problems in life. So you ask yourself, what are the things I should do to support my practice that enables me to be mindful, that doesn't stir up the defilements unnecessarily? This is what clear comprehension is about, full awareness. You know to avoid certain things, and you do those things that are supportive of your practice. That's really what it is about. Okay, so what is the supporting factor for this? The supporting factor for lack of mindfulness is careless attention. Yoniso Manasikara. And Yoniso Manasikara, one of these very significant and important things on the Buddhist path. Yoniso Manasikara means wise attention, careful attention, this sort of stuff. And the idea here is that we have to kind of attend to the world in the right way, think about the world in the right way, and when we do that, then it leads to all of these other things. And careful attention is actually something that comes with us all the way on the full, everywhere on the path. At the very beginning, when you decide, you know, to be a Buddhist, or you decide to kind of practice the Buddhist teaching, or you decide to be more kind, or you decide to do anything that you do which is right, which leads you in the right direction on the path, is called yoniso manasikara. Anything which is wrong, which leads you on the wrong path, yeah? Like here we have ayoniso manasikara, all that is ayoniso manasikara. Whenever you think something wrong, which leads in the wrong direction, you are thinking wrongly, ayoniso manasikara. So if you, this is actually defined in one of the suttas, the Sabbasava Sutta, the second sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, and it defines yoniso manasikara as any thought, where when you think that or you attend in that particular way, the defilements increase and the good states of mind decline. Did I get that right? So when it's ayoniso manasikara, the defilements increase, the good states of the mind decline. If it's yoniso manasikara, the good states increase and the defilements go down. This is how you know whether something is yoniso or ayoniso manasikara. It's how we attend to the world, how we look at the world. It's a kind of basic outlook with things. A very important factor on the path. And the cause here and condition for this yoniso manasikara, according to this particular sutta, is confidence, faith. It is our faith that actually, this our faith in the Buddha and confidence in the Buddhist teachings that help us to look at the world in the right way, so we can actually make the right decisions, we can attend on things in the right way. It's kind of interesting because yoniso manasikara is usually considered a kind of a wisdom practice. We call it wise attention, or wise awareness. But here, the wisdom comes from faith, it comes from confidence. And this is kind of the point. The point is that at the beginning, we have to lean on somebody else. This is the whole point about delusion, creating more delusion. The only way you're going to break out of that circle is to rely on someone else to begin with, to then enable you to think in the right way, to attend in the right way. So the Buddha tells us, if you think like this, it will have good results. If you think like that, it will have bad results. And you look at it and think, yeah, that makes sense, because it kind of ties well together. You try it out and you see that it actually works. Yeah. So this is why the confidence in the Buddha's teachings actually enables us then to think in the right way. From that confidence, gradually, as you practice according to how the Buddha says, you make it your own wisdom. Yeah, you start to see how it works. You start to understand that what the Buddha is talking about, actually it applies directly to your own life. And as you do that, you move from faith and confidence, you move to understanding and wisdom instead. And then Yoni Somani Sikhar becomes very powerful, because now it is your understanding that it is based on, and that is much more powerful than faith or confidence. One of the things that is interesting in Buddhism and makes it very different from any other teachings in the world, any other religions really as well, is that from a Buddhist point of view, faith and wisdom are not contradictory. They always go together. Yeah, so when you start off on the Buddhist path, you start off with confidence and faith, and you haven't got that much wisdom at that particular point. But then as you practice the path, your wisdom increases a little bit. And as your wisdom increases, so does your confidence. Yeah, in the teachings. The faith actually increases with the wisdom. These are not opposites. They actually go together. And when you come to the point that you have absolute faith and absolute confidence because you have seen these teachings for yourself, that is also the point when your wisdom reaches the highest level. Confidence and faith always going together. In some other teachings, they are opposed to each other. Yeah, you have confidence because you don't understand anything, because you have no wisdom. Okay, you have faith. Yeah, and faith is really the kind of the final thing in certain systems of thought. But in Buddhism, it's the other way around. In Buddhism, knowledge, understanding, and faith and confidence actually grow together. Confidence is an outcome of knowledge and understanding. Why is it that you have confidence in the teachings of the Buddha anyway? Well, because they make sense. Yeah, this is why, at least that's the case for me, it makes sense to me. That's why I have confidence in these things. It is not just a blind adherence to something just because, you know, I think I got to hold on to something in this world. Okay, what am I going to, okay, I'll take the teachings of the Buddha. It's not like that. It's because actually these things make sense and they work out. It's kind of interesting. Confidence leads to the wisdom of Yoni Somani Sikhara. That's where it started. We start off by taking the word of Buddha on trust, and then gradually it becomes more and more powerful. Where does that faith come from? The faith comes from listening to the word of the Buddha. The more you listen to it, the more you listen to these teachings, the more faith you tend to get. Or you get less faith. Maybe think, what? Yeah, that's okay. If you do get less faith when you read the teachings of the Buddha, it's okay, because the reason it is okay is because this is the only way, this is the way the path works, yeah? And if you are not ready for the teachings, and you're not ready for this, and you want to do something else, that's just the way it is. And that's okay as well. Then you move away from Buddhism. But the majority of people will then gain more faith and confidence as they read this. So it is always the right thing to explore the teachings of the Buddha, regardless of the actual outcome eventually. What is it that allows us to get to hear the word of the Buddha? It is seeing the noble ones, seeing the Buddha, hanging out with the Buddha. Yeah, like I was said during the public talk on Sunday, you got to be the Buddha's disciple. The Buddha was thinking about us 2,500 years ago. Yeah, he was thinking into the future and realized that there would be people far, far down the line who will still be listening to his teachings. And that's why he spoke those teachings in such a way that they would be relevant to us today. We are the disciples of the Buddha right now. Whenever you read the suttas, you are in the presence of the Buddha. He was thinking about us when he gave those teachings. Yeah. So you are, in a very real sense, you are a disciple of the Buddha, and you are hanging out with the Buddha when you're reading the suttas. So hang out with the Buddha, yeah. Don't forget that hanging out with the Buddha is a good thing. Don't be afraid of the Buddha. He's kind. He has no defilements. It's not going to hurt you. Yeah. So hang out with the Buddha and listen to his teachings. And also listen to teachings of others as well, because, you know, people who have the ability to kind of inspire you and who you feel have a proper understanding of the teachings, that's also a place to go. All of these things support each other, and then you are on the right track as a consequence. So hanging out with the wrong people then is the root cause for delusion. Hanging out with the right people is the root cause of vijja, of knowledge, of non-delusion. So that is what we have to do. This is what we have to do more and more and more. That's why I say to people always, yeah, come back to the teachings again and again and again. Reflect on them. Try to understand what is going on. And as you do that, this whole path tends to happen all by itself, because you are getting brainwashed. Yeah. People think, Ajahn Brahm used to say this when I went to the monastery in Perth, that, yeah, you have come here. I said to Ajahn Brahm, you know, one of your kind of, Ajahn Shah used to say, have you come to this monastery to die? That's what he used to say, yeah? And people, what are you talking about? Yeah, I'm not ready to die yet. But the point is that are you willing to kind of give everything for the Dhamma? That's kind of the idea there. Yeah? And I said to Ajahn Brahm, your slogan should be, have you come to the monastery to get brainwashed? That should be Ajahn Brahm's slogan. Because that's what he used to say in the early days. Yeah, welcome. This is the, you know, welcome to the brainwashing camp, the Bodhinyana Monastery here. And when I was a young monk, I thought, what do you mean by brainwashing? I don't want to be brainwashed. But of course, once you start to understand what is going on, you start to realize you have no choice. You've got to be brainwashed. Yeah? If you're not going to be brainwashed by the Dhamma, you're going to be brainwashed by somebody else. You're going to be brainwashed by the commercials. That's why everyone wants to have BMWs, because they think the commercials are so cool. Yeah? I've got to have a BMW. I've got to have this. I've got to have that. We are brainwashed by society. And this is kind of the whole point of understanding the idea of non-self, is that because we are the sum total of causes and conditions of the environment around us, then that is exactly the meaning of brainwashing. There is no individual entity inside of us which steers us clearly. Rather, everything is brainwashing. So it comes down to choosing the right kind of brainwashing. That's what it comes down to. Yeah. So make sure that you choose good brainwashing. Choose the brainwashing that makes you happy. Yeah, it gives you true happiness. Don't choose the stupid brainwashing that actually doesn't brainwash you at all. It brainwashes you in the way that you do what it says, but it doesn't brainwash you in the sense that you become cleaner on the other end. If you get the Buddha's brainwashing, actually, you come out clean. Yeah? If you take the commercials on TV brainwashing, you come out even more dirty. It's terrible. Yeah, more desire, more ill will, more confusion. So which one are you going to take? Are you going to take the one that makes you clean? Or are you going to, it's like putting it in the washing machine, your clothes come out even more dirty on the other end. This washing machine is no good. Let's get another one. Let's get some real washing powder. Get the Buddha brand. Yeah, the Buddha brand is the best one. Forget about these other brands. They are no good. The Buddha brand washing powder. This is not a quote from the sutta. This is kind of elaborating a little bit. Yeah, but essentially it is from the suttas. This is what this is all about. It's a nice way of thinking about it, because it kind of gets to the root problem here, that we are so very strongly conditioned by the world around us, and it's very hard to actually to avoid that unless you then have a teacher like the Buddha who can bring us out of that and can show us the world in a different way. So let us just finish off this little sutta here. Yeah. Thus, not associating with good person, becoming full, fills up not hearing the good Dhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma becoming full fills up lack of faith. Lack of faith becoming full fills up the careless attention. Careless attention becoming full fills up lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct becoming full fill up the five hindrances. The five hindrances becoming full fill up delusion. Thus, there is a nutriment for delusion, and in this way, it becomes full. That's bad news, yeah? Filling up delusion, it sounds terrible. You're absolutely, delusion is kind of permeating you everywhere, yeah? Delusion is no end to it. It's absolutely, it's overflowing at the bounds of your personality even. And it comes here from the very beginning of not associating with good persons becoming full. So make sure you don't do that. Don't fill up the associating with bad persons. And then you avoid the filling up of all of these kind of things, yeah? Filling up the three kinds of misconduct. Sounds terrible. Filling up the five hindrances. It's kind of very bad kind of sequence. So make sure you avoid this bad sequence. And as you avoid that, you fill up the opposite sequence, which is the exact opposite. I will read out the opposite sequence when we come closer to the very end of the retreat. Then you have this nice, beautiful simile that symbolizes what is going on here. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on the mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean. In this way it becomes full. Yeah, so when it rains on the mountaintop, yeah, what happens? Eventually that rain, if it keeps on raining for long enough, the rain force makes little streams, yeah, little gullies, and these streams become kind of flow down and fill up the lakes. If the stream runs for long enough, then of course those lakes eventually become full. Yeah, after the drought, the lakes become full. Then out of those lakes come the large rivers. Yeah, and the large rivers swell during the monsoon season because it's raining so much. And all of that goes into the ocean, and the ocean is then filled up again with water. What goes out of the ocean comes back in again. And all you have to do is to make sure it keeps on raining on that mountaintop. If you keep on raining on that mountaintop, this will inevitably happen. It may take a while, because those lakes may take a while to fill up. The streams take a while to become really large streams. The rivers take a while to really swell. So you have to keep on raining. Yeah? Keep on raining, raining, raining. Sometimes it may rain for years before this happens. Yeah, but eventually, as the rain keeps going, this process is bound to happen as a consequence. So make sure that you rain in your daily life. Your rain is to go back to the source. Go back to the suttas. Listen to the word of the Buddha. Listen to other teachings that point you in the same direction, whatever those teachings may be. And as you keep on that rain of the Dhamma in your life, you keep on brainwashing yourself, yeah, quite literally, coming out more pure on the other end. As you keep on doing that, this process happens almost by itself. The streams is the faith, yeah, the lakes becoming full, is the yonisomanasikara growing, you're starting to become clear about what's required. The rivers becoming large, is the hindrance is coming down, and eventually delusion itself is destroyed, and you get understanding, and you see things according to reality. It's the ocean becoming fuller. So all you have to do is keep the rain going. Keep the rain going. Come back to the suttas. Come back to right view. Come back to seeing things according to reality. Reflect on these things. Don't just listen. Reflect. Because when you reflect, you make these things your own. One thing is sitting here listening to me. Yeah? Maybe you think, yeah, this, you know, this is okay. It's not so bad. Yeah? But when you reflect on this and you make it your own, much more powerful than just me talking about these things. When it's your own, it becomes real to you. When it becomes real to you, it becomes something powerful in your life. When I teach you, all it is just me blabbering away. But when you gain this insight for yourself, it becomes very powerful. All of this is part of that beginning, allowing the teachings to soak in, reflecting on them, allowing them to grow inside of you. The process then just happens all by itself. Causality working itself out. The law of causality being so important in the Buddhist teachings. And this is how this works. is so beautiful in a sense, yeah? It's so nice, it's so easy in so many ways. If you understand what you have to do, it's kind of this wonderful thing that actually happens there. All you have to do is to put the basis into action, and it all happens as a consequence. So that is this sutta on the causes for delusion. Of course, as you read that, you start to understand also very clearly what are the causes for non-delusion. And we'll have a look at that later on when we come further down the path and we look at these teachings in a bit more detail. So there you are. Are you happy with that? Yeah, you're happy? Great, wonderful. Yes, Doris. I've learned your name, you see? Now which one? Ah, you're Jennifer. Ah, really? Okay, very good. Okay, great. Yeah. Defilement and delusion. Okay. So, delusion is a kind of defilement. Yeah. But when we talk about defilements, we normally talk about more than just delusion. Delusion is, if you like, the root defilement, the root problem in the mind. But it's actually broader than that. So when we talk about defilements, we often talk about the three kinds of defilements, lobha, dosa, moha. Lobha being basically greed or sensuality and this kind of things. Dosa being ill will, anger, that kind of things. And moha, in this case, it means really more like confusion. It's a mixture of confusion and delusion. Yeah, but the root problem is always delusion. The root problem, if you don't have any delusion, you will not have desire and ill will either. The ultimate source for all of these things is actually delusion. So defilement and delusion is really, that's how they relate to each other. From delusion, all the defilements arise, all the problems arise from delusion, the source of all these problems. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything here? You're all stunned by the Dhamma. That's nice, isn't it? That's nice just to be stunned. You're so okay. No need to say anything. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Okay. So if that is the case, we will just call it a morning, and then we'll have a nice lunch together, and we'll see you back, not at 2, but at 1:45, yeah? I finally got it. I finally kind of grasped it. See you again at 1:45 this afternoon.